This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
This today is the third in a series of debates we're doing for important offices in the county and in the state. The office in question this time is Maricopa County Attorney. I want to tell you for a moment why I chose this office to invite candidates to debate. The county attorney is, in my opinion, the most important position in the entire criminal justice system. Judges can preside over cases that are brought to them. If someone's convicted, there are often mandatory sentence guidelines that constrain what they can sentence. Defense attorneys have to defend their clients, whether they think they're guilty or innocent. That's not a bad thing. It's their job, and it's important. But when a police officer arrests someone, it's up to the county attorney to decide whether to prosecute a case, whether to drop it, whether to send the defendant into some sort of diversion program, and exactly what to charge. That's a huge amount of discretionary power. Charges for many offenses can vary greatly with huge differences in penalty. And in most crimes in Arizona, particularly violent crimes, they tend to be handled by county attorneys, not by the attorney general. Bottom line, this is a very important job. I'd like to welcome the two candidates for Maricopa County Attorney to the Think Tank. The current county attorney, Alistair Adele, was appointed to that position late last year when her predecessor was appointed to the Arizona Supreme Court. Her challenger is Judy Gunigal. To my knowledge, neither has been previously elected to any public office. By the way, I deliberately didn't mention party. You can look that up. I'd ask our listeners, however, to, in the spirit of bipartisanship, to listen to what these candidates have to say first. If you feel like it, you can look up party or anything else later. Let me start by giving you a rough, shortened version of what the rules are. And they're as follows. There'll be opening questions and we've agreed on times for all of these things. In the opening section, they will then alternate questions between the candidates. In the third segment, we afford each candidate the opportunity to ask the other a question, and there will be an opportunity for the original person. Every time somebody gets a statement, they get a minute to do it. The other person gets to respond. If the original person wants to respond to that, they have the option of responding for 30 seconds, which gives the other candidate an opportunity to respond in kind. In other words, we keep it equal throughout. Timing. You will hear a beep when you have 10 seconds to go, and it will sound like this. When 20 seconds later, when you are 10 seconds actually over the agreed upon time, you'll hear a second, hopefully louder and more obnoxious sound. That means you've gone over. For the 1 minute statements, that means that these warnings come at 50 seconds and 70 seconds for an allotted time of 60 seconds. We will track the total time used by each candidate for the first 3 segments. Our engineer Bronwyn will do that. At that point, we'll ask her what the total looks like. If there's a disparity of more than a minute, there'll be makeup time in the 4th segment in the final statements that will be awarded to the non-filibustering candidate. That's a constraint on that filibuster. If it's less than a minute, we'll ignore it as de minimis. And you're free to allow to use less than the allotted time for each question. I want to start by asking Ms. Gunigal, if you're elected to this office, what's the very first thing you would do?
Good question. The organization of this office reflects its priorities. And in my view, the organization right now doesn't reflect what the priorities of this office ought to be, which is to be tough, to be smart, to be fair. When I say tough, I'm not talking about traditional tough on crime rhetoric. I'm about prioritizing this office to focus on crimes of violence, crimes that target women, children, and our seniors, human trafficking, and public corruption. think we need to be smart on crime too. And I'm the only candidate in this race who is specifically committed to ending our incarceration crisis, which bankrupts our state at a cost of $1.2 billion a year in our prison bills, more than we spend in our world-class university system, community college system, and public health system combined. I'm also interested in making this office more fair and acknowledging that Maricopa County has some of the worst racial disparities when it comes to policing and prosecution in the nation. And that's a legacy that needs to end. So I'm in this race so that we can rebuild this office, turn the page, and put an end to the failures that have originated out of our county attorney's office.
Alistair Adele, your response. No, not a response. Let me adjust the question. What is the first thing you did when you did take office?
Well, I appreciate the question. I'm proud to be your Maricopa County attorney in the third largest jurisdiction in the country. After going to ASU Law School to be a prosecutor, I spent 7 years prosecuting violent offenders and then was appointed to executive level leadership roles in Arizona government. All while keeping my commitment to our community. I'm a proud past president of Phoenix Rotary. During my year, we focused our efforts on raising money and awareness to combat human trafficking in our community. I'm also proud to be the first woman chair of the 100 Club of Arizona and was recently appointed to be the chair of the advisory board for child help. Since my appointment a year ago, I made a commitment to transparency and accountability. Over the last year, we started working hard to implement many, many programs, and I'm proud to say many of those have come to fruition to focus on smart justice and recidivism reduction. The first is we have a forward-facing data dashboard. Anyone in the public can go look at our website and see the types of cases that we're prosecuting, their resolution and demographics. I created a robust diversion program for those that want to do better and be better, because we look at the offender, not just the offense. We're collaborative with our community advisory boards. And on the civil side of our house, we have taken back non-contested adoptions in-house for our lawyers because those were gone under my predecessor. So now loving children can find a home, and it has saved the taxpayers $750,000 a year. So I'm committed to keep working on projects such as this. And we have so much that's been in the works that's taken a little bit longer than I'd like to do with prosecution with the pandemic. But things like our plea policies have changed. We have a prosecution integrity unit. I'm so proud of the hard work of the 1,000 men and women in our office that we've been accomplishing the last 3 years. And again, I'm Alistair Dell, and I'm proud to be your first woman county attorney. And you can learn more about me on my website, alistairdell.com.
Julie Gunnigal, opportunity to respond if you wish.
Well, I just want to briefly introduce myself as well. So I'm Julie Gunnigal, and you can find more about me at gunnigal2020.com. I was born, raised, and educated right here in Arizona. And after earning a degree in chemistry from NAU, I attended Notre Dame Law School, where I graduated with honors, was the top trial attorney in my class, and have had my work cited to the United States Supreme Court. I worked as a prosecutor in Indiana and in Illinois, going after corrupt politicians who stole public funds, getting justice for families, and holding people accountable when they broke the law. After one too many blizzards, I moved back here to raise my family. And now I have a civil practice where I practice in civil litigation and defend the rights of children to access education when they have disabilities. Again, you can learn more about me and my campaign at gunnigal2020.com.
Alistair Adele, you get the last word in this segment.
Oh, I'm good. Thank you, though.
Okay, in that case, we will be back in a moment in the think tank, and the next question will go to Ms. Adele. We'll be back in just a moment.
The morning lights, the streets that lead them, and sirens call them on with a song.
The think tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are talking to the candidates for Maricopa County Attorney. The incumbent is Alistair Adele, and her challenger is Julie Gunnigal. We're alternating the questions between the candidates, and the next question goes to Ms. Adele. And the question is this. The U.S. imprisons more people at a higher rate than any other country in the world. And Arizona imprisons at a higher rate than all but four other states. Not only are there human costs to this, to those folks and their families, but there's a taxpayer burden on that as well. Even the conservative Koch brothers have supported reining in long sentences that are both expensive and often ineffective. I ask you because the Maricopa County attorney is probably in a position to impact this more than any other agency. Multiple question. Why do you think we incarcerate so many people? Do you think we over-incarcerate? And if you think that's a problem, what would you do about it?
Well, the incarceration rate that's out there right now is mainly from my predecessor. During the pandemic, we have been avoiding sending people to prison. In fact, we've worked collaboratively with our stakeholders to make sure that the jail population is reduced for those that are awaiting sentencing or already post-conviction that are in our jails because of the COVID crisis. Prior to the COVID crisis, I have been working with stakeholders like legislators, community groups that want to see our criminal justice succeed, and also with the governor. And if you remember in his State of the State address, he talked about eliminating one of the prisons. And I truly don't believe this is just a legislative solution. It's incumbent upon us as prosecutors to make sure that we are doing our part for our community. Because once somebody is institutionalized, they're at a much higher rate to repeat their crimes and recidivate. We want people to be successful. That's why I have changed all of our plea policies in the last year in our office to allow for more discretion, to allow for a sentence that looks at the offender, not the offense, because we many of us know these crimes are often being committed by those who have mental health issues, drug addictions. And that's why we created a diversion program. I'm proud to say that we eliminated a financial barrier that was charged previously of a minimum of $630 just to participate. And we've moved on now to an evidence-based program where they can get their criminogenic needs evaluated and get the help that they need so they can be back and working and successful and not institutionalized. So when we talk about prison population, it takes a lot of us in this to look at it. There's laws that need to be changed. We were working with the legislature to soften some of the laws out there for crime. But also, I have been committed to this and I have a proven track record of making some of these things absolutely attainable. And I'm proud to say our prosecutors have embraced this.
Julie Gonigal?
Sure. So first, you're right. Arizona is the fifth largest incarcerator in the country, and that makes us the eighth largest incarcerator in the world. We spend $28,000 a year-ish for every person who is behind bars. And that's a legacy that we just can't continue. Frankly, I'm surprised to hear that there's a commitment from our current unelected county attorney to stop these practices, given that when she applied for this job, she said that she would be proud to build upon the legacy of Bill Montgomery. And it really is folks like Bill Montgomery and Andrew Thomas who have given us the legacy of mass incarceration. So my campaign has set a smart decarceration goal to bring Arizona during the course of 4 years down 26% in our rate of incarceration. That brings us down to the median in the nation, states like Utah. And it also saves us $250 million a year. And I think that's really important that we are fiscally responsible and that when we're charging persons and cases, that we are doing so with all of the interests of justice in mind, our community that's been harmed, the person who has allegedly committed the offense, but also the taxpayers who have to pay for all of this justice.
Alistair, if you wish to respond further.
No, when I started, I knew that I wanted to do better, be better, and help restore faith in our criminal justice system. And that's why we have a great team around us that started working on these things day one. And I'm proud of the efforts that we've made. This is something that is a community issue as well. And that's why I engage with our community members and their voices, because I'm going to stand on my record of doing what's right for the office and our community and keeping the public safe.
Julie, you have 30 seconds.
Well, sure. I mean, I'd like to talk about the community members that I've been engaging with, too, because, you know, our biggest voices for criminal justice reform, folks like Representative Rodriguez and Representative Boulding, Senator Navarrete and Senator Quezada, they've all endorsed me and my campaign because they know that when we get into office come November, that we are going to be that voice for real criminal justice reform. because it's always been part of our platform, you know, for the last 18 months that we've been running. I know that it's really important to have that commitment and to have that commitment early, because when you have somebody who's been in office for 13 months, it's not enough to start making reforms a mere 13 weeks before an election. You need to have that commitment for the entire course.
Time is a horrible master. We've got maybe 30, 40 seconds each. I have a question that I want to ask you about cash bail. If I get arrested for something, I'm going to post bail. If somebody is totally broke, they probably stay in jail. If you're moderately broke, you have to go to a bail bondsman, put up 10% of the amount in cash. Even if you're completely exonerated, you're out that money. Shouldn't we only, and these are people who haven't been convicted of a crime. And I'm sorry, it's 30 seconds each, but I want to go first to Julie. How do you feel about cash bail?
You're absolutely right. Our cash bond system disproportionately imprisons our most marginalized citizens. We know that at a few days being held, they will lose employment. A few weeks, they will lose housing. In a few months, they'll be separated, likely permanently, from our family. I'm committed that when elected, my prosecutors will stop asking for cash bail and that we will be at the legislature advocating for statutory reform.
Alistair Adele, you get the last word on this.
Well, I actually worked for the agency pretrial services before I went to law school, so I'm very familiar with this topic. And I can tell you that bond is taken very seriously. A judge imposes a release conditions based on an assessment, and it is not there to be punitive. It is there to ensure appearance in court, protect the community, to protect victims. And I can tell you that our lawyers rarely ever ask for cash bond. And that is coming from me. It's the least onerous conditions. So I believe you can look towards the legislature, but also realize the judge imposes those conditions.
We're out of time. We'll be back in a minute with more debate in the think tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with the candidates for Maricopa County Attorney, Alistair Adele and Judy Gunigal. Julie Gunigal, you get to ask your opponent a question.
Yes, thank you. County Attorney Adele, you stated in an interview that if Roe v. Wade is ever overturned, the law must be upheld, but that you don't believe that women will be prosecuted for abortions. You asked to be shown where the law is because you believed it was absolutely nonsensical. The law is ARS 13-3603, 3604, and 3605 that create a mandatory minimum for people accessing abortion and criminalize contraceptives. Yes or no, will you uphold the law and prosecute women for seeking or obtaining an abortion were Roe v. Wade to be overturned?
I can tell you that during my more than 7 years as a prosecutor and then my time leading the office now, we have never prosecuted a woman for an abortion. They're going through a painful situation. That is an archaic law that would have to be dusted off. We also do not have law enforcement submitting cases on that because we haven't had any submittals, and we're not an investigative agency. We're a prosecution agency. We are a law firm. And that's why we focus our resources on going after the worst of the worst, focusing our resources on keeping the public safe. Whatever happens within someone's four walls or their personal life, that is not necessarily something that we need to be concerned with. But I will tell you, yes, as a prosecutor, you can't pick and choose what cases you prosecute. But if law enforcement doesn't submit cases to you, you're not investigated. So that's an issue for you to take up with the legislature.
Julie, a response if you want.
Well, I mean, I didn't hear a yes or a no there. I think this shows how little my opponent understands about prosecutorial discretion, because a prosecutor is required to act first with the interests of justice in mind, and it's not a command to act robotically without judgment or common sense and carry out every nuance in the law. Of course, she's not receiving referrals right now because Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land. But the question was, were Roe v. Wade to fall, would she prosecute women for abortion and contraceptives? And that's the question she didn't answer.
Alistair.
I'd love to see where there's a case out there right now if Roe v. Wade is going to fall. Certainly, if we had that conversation, we have the conversation in a sensible manner as a community. But to speculate is simply irresponsible.
Okay, Alistair, you get to ask the question now.
Well, we already talked about bond, and so I'm going to move on to a different topic. Ms. Gunigal, when you were a prosecutor in Cook County, there was a woman, an African-American woman, who you signed the arrest warrant, and she was held in jail for $300,000 for 20 months and had to have a hysterectomy for an eavesdropping charge that was ultimately found unconstitutional, and she was found not guilty. And then you and your co-counsel were sued in federal court and were stripped of your immunity. And I know you say the case was dismissed. That's correct. That's what happens when you settle out of court. And I know you say you didn't pay anything. And that's absolutely correct. You're right, because the taxpayers of Chicago paid nearly $1 million. So my question for you, was that the last trial that you did in Chicago before you moved here to be dean of students at the now failed Summit School of Law?
So listen, voters are tired of these baseless and disproven smears and the Martha McSally style debate tactics. You know, I was one of 16 people who was named in that suit that was settled, and it was settled because of prison health care. I wasn't stripped of my immunity. It was dismissed, and there was no finding of misconduct. I think it's beneath the dignity of this office to continue to push out these sort of lies, because voters care about fixing our broken criminal justice system. They care about making sure that the sentence fits the crime. And I would say that this is in direct opposition, because unlike my opponent, who's, you know, doubled down on an 8-year sentence for a senior failing to return a rental car on time and is, I guess, now promised to prosecute women for their health care should Roe v. Wade be overturned. My proposed changes are going to keep our community safe, and they're going to save taxpayers $250 million a year. I've been fighting for reform for years, not just in the last 13 weeks before an election like my opponent. Looking at our respective records, my opponent and I could not be any more different on the issue of criminal justice reform. And I want the audience to know that I'm going to continue to fight for smart reforms that'll keep us safe and save us money.
Alistair, you have an option for a brief response if you choose.
Well, again, I stand on my record. And you stated at the beginning of this, party line shouldn't be a factor. You're there to uphold the law. And we talk about ethical excellence every day. And I said that in my first annual meeting because, look, I was on the State Bar Ethics Committee. It's important to me. But I encourage every voter out there to make informed decisions. Go to websites, learn more about us, and then you make an informed decision for what is best to keep our community safe.
Julie, also a brief comment?
I'm good.
Okay. Next question is for Alistair in the alternative. We talked about prison, the degree of incarceration, but, you know, most people agree that at some point, I'm not talking now about diversion programs, but at some point, punishment is in order. But even within the realm of punishment, my question to you is, do we still, even within that realm of punishment, use incarceration as a one-size-fits-all solution? For example, I think of, you know, sometimes mandatory work requirements can be seen as a slap on the wrist. If you're asked to go out for a weekend and rake leaves, that may be the case. But what if somebody gave you 1,000 hours? That's the equivalent of 6 months, or 10,000 hours is like 5 years of work. In other words, are there alternatives even within the realm of punishment to imprisonment that can be more useful for society and more conducive to rehabilitation?
Well, absolutely. I want to point out that studies show when people are sent to prison or jail for a certain amount of time, they're institutionalized and more likely to reoffend. And that's why we focus on recidivism reduction efforts. And you mentioned one of them, diversion. We now, since May, have offered this to 3,000 people to get them to be successful. I'm also proud to say that it's taken us a long time to do this, but in collaboration with our justice courts, we now have the first ever home detention program for those who commit DUIs. So there's little disruption to employment, to family, to school, because that is one of those programs that we need to put forth to make sure we are not incarcerating people. And finally, because I have changed all of our plea policies, you're now allowed to have people get into diversion, get the help they need, be successful, so they're not stuck with traditional prosecution and a felony on their record, which is a barrier to employment and housing. So it's a broad spectrum of things that we have been working on for a long time. And again, before pandemic, I was working at the legislature to remove different barriers to diversity, to look at sensible expungement laws. And it was bipartisan on both sides of the aisle. And two of the people that Ms. Gunnickel represented invited me recently to a stakeholder meeting. So we have these ongoing conversations in a formal capacity with the people that can actually make the changes. And we are committed to being the driving force behind that, because we've already been in this space doing this work.
Julie?
Yes, I mean, the problem is that it's just too little too late when you are the eighth largest incarcerator in the country, and when our prison budget threatens to bankrupt our state. It's a disaster of titanic proportions, and we're headed toward a collision, and my opponent is writing strongly worded letters to the iceberg. We need to be able to change, and change quickly. It's one of the reasons why I've been in favor of specialty courts like Veterans Pre-adjudication Justice Court. And one of the things that that does for felonies is make sure that our veterans population, and here in Arizona, we have the third highest veterans population in the entire country, that they're able to get truly wraparound services and avoid the forever consequences of having a felony on their record. They're able to be set up with housing, with employment, and be able to access the full gamut with the VA. And the good news is we have these courts already operating in the municipal settings and on the probation department. So bringing it in to be pre-adjudication and felony would be a great step. We also have other opportunities for things like drug court and deflection. I would note that there's big issues right now within our diversion program that my opponent keeps touting because, and this is something that sadly I have personal experience with my group of family and friends, it's not evidence-based to only offer someone diversion once. And that's our current policy. Offer it once and you're done. And anyone who's worked with someone who's experienced addiction knows that that's not what the cycle of recovery looks like. It looks like relapse. It looks like failures. It looks like striving to, as she puts it, you know, do better and be better. But that path isn't always direct. And what we need to do is have an absolute policy that no one is sent to prison for no other reason than substance use disorder. You can't incarcerate addiction out of a person.
We'll be back in the think tank with candidates Alistair Adele and Julie Gunnickel, who are candidates for Maricopa County Attorney, when we return in the think tank in just a moment. Streets that lead them and sirens call them on.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are talking to the candidates for Maricopa County Attorney, Alistair Adele and Judy Gunnickel. I have a question for Ms. Adele. It was Page One News recently when your office decided not to charge State Trooper George Cervantes with a crime involved in the shooting death of Deion Johnson on May 25th. I don't want to ask you about the specifics of that case, but I do want to ask about what would seem to me to be an inherent conflict of interest, not in a legal sense, but in a practical sense, with any office that is charged with investigating police officers, yet has to every single day work cooperatively with those same agencies. When a police officer is charged with brutality or with killing a civilian or any other offense, you make the charging decision. If you elect to charge the officer, you potentially tick off the organization you have to work with. My question is, wouldn't it make sense to have charges against a police officer investigated by somebody that does not depend upon the goodwill to work with the police on a daily basis?
Well, to be clear, we don't investigate officers. Again, we are a law firm. And I have said over and over and over again that if you commit a crime in this county, whether you're an officer or not, you will be held accountable. It's often not reported that under my tenure, we have reported prosecuted many, many police officers, one with an officer-involved shooting, one who assaulted women on the way to jail, others for pornography, you name it. We prosecute officers all the time. I will tell you, though, in reviewing officer-involved shootings, I take this very seriously. We have a critical incident review team made up of prosecutors that I expanded immediately when I got there to include non-lawyers on there. And now, finally, we've got civilians on there from the outside that help put a critical eye to this and see what is the evidence that we can actually bring in at trial. How can we do our ethical duty to stick with our charging standard of reasonable likelihood of conviction? And to intimate that is a conflict of interest is simply a distraction, a red herring. These committee members make a recommendation to me, and I ultimately make the decision, because it would be unethical to go forward on something where we can't. But again, we have charged officers. So it's important to note that when there's things out there in the media, they get spun. You know, a loss of life is difficult anytime. And nothing I can say or do will comfort Mr. Johnson's family. And there was a lot of talk about, you know, us not looking at the trooper's record or Mr. Johnson's record. You know why? We didn't look at either of their records. We looked at what was going to come in at trial and what we could prove ethically beyond a reasonable doubt with our ethical charging standard. So we do have an independent group. Yes. Are there prosecutors from our office on there? Yes. They have great experience. We also have civilian members. And I'm absolutely confident that they are doing the right thing for the right reasons.
Julie.
I'm not absolutely confident. You know, Mike, I think you hit the nail right on the head. And it's a day one priority for me to have an independent unit to evaluate police use of force cases, because it is absolutely a conflict of interest to ask prosecutors who work day in and day out with the fine folks in uniform to go ahead and hold them responsible and accountable when there's an alleged improper use of force. I would note that I'm not the only one that's saying this. You know, we've had an office that's unwilling to admit that this is a problem and is unwilling to listen to leaders, particularly leaders in the Black community that she's placed on her own advisory team, who have said that this position and the way that this process is working does not inspire community trust. If we want to rebuild community trust, we need to have a transparent process. And that's not what we have right now. We have a critical incident review team where the public doesn't even know who these individuals are and they're advising on these cases. They're subject to non-disclosure agreements and they're hand selected by our county attorney. I would note that it doesn't have to be this way. When Phoenix implemented its citizen advisory council, it did so in a forward-facing way where you can go to the website and see exactly who's advising. But this process isn't transparent now. And that's evident not just in the fact that we don't have true independence, but that this office didn't even have the DPS file that would have revealed that Trooper Cervantes tased a puppy 3 times with a state-issued taser, and then our unelected county attorney relied on Google to do the homework about what his background looks like. And if we're truly invested in justice and equity, what we need to be doing in this case is making sure that this sort of conduct never happens again.
I have a follow-up question I want to ask, and it goes to you, Julie, just because it's your time. I saw a presentation at Harvard last week by Professor Rajiv Sethi of Columbia, and one of the slides just jumped off the page at me. And I followed up with several communications with him to verify that I was interpreting correctly. He presented the number of deadly police shootings by city for the 10 largest cities for the last 6 years, from 2013 to 2018, pointing out that that is not within the domain of the current incumbent. He looked at this broken down separately by population, by number of officers, and by number of violent crimes in the relevant community. It jumped off the page at me that Phoenix was number one on all three measures. It was 7.5 times the rate. It was number one. It was 7.5 times the rate of New York on a per capita basis, meaning population, 17 times the rate on a per officer basis, and 6.5 times the rate on a per crime committed basis. My question is, the obvious follow-up for these are staggering numbers. Do we have a problem here? It appears by this data that we have a unique problem in the Phoenix area. The question goes to you, Julie.
Yes, I agree. We have a unique problem in the Phoenix area. Police officers have shot 600 people in the past 8 years, and only one has faced charges. The reforms that I've been proposing incorporate what the data confirms and what the community already knows, that when you have a system that insulates, you know, both our law enforcement and our county attorney from any sort of transparency efforts and community involvement, you end up not seeing folks held accountable, and it leads to community distrust and the idea that no one is above the law. I would note that it is profoundly pro-law enforcement to want to hold those who have a badge, those who should be protecting and serving, to the highest possible standards. And it is with that in mind that we need an independent unit for police use of force cases.
Alistair, to you on the subject of the disparity.
We leave a lot to our police departments for training, and I'm happy to say that we've been engaging with them more on DLS escalation training, mental health training, things like that, so that we can resolve situations. Again, I want to be real clear, though, on the Google comment. First of all, I don't have time to Google anything. I am way too busy running this third largest prosecution agency in the country. This was something that was told to me, and DPS is the one that wouldn't hold over the fire, not us. So we have a statutory obligation at the county attorney's office to investigate these. So that would be something that my opponent would just need to go to the legislature. I know that's a lot of what she wants to do, but you'd have to get that changed. Now, we did send one case out to the AG for a conflict. And when there's a conflict, we send it out to another agency. The reason why we aren't releasing the names of those on the critical incident committee is to protect their safety. They're also dealing with privileged documents. And as you know, it is our ethical duty to protect a defendant's right to be free of pretrial publicity so as to keep them safe. And as to use of force, we've instructed our deputy county attorneys that if they see something in a report or a body cam, to report it. And I'm proud to say that we have established that unit now. They will be the repository for all this and working with our law enforcement partner on training and education so that we can make sure that we are doing this in the right way. If our officers are behaving badly, and some of them do, they will be held accountable.
We have run out of broadcast time. We're going to do what we did in our first debate, which is we will do final statements, and those will be something that you can listen to on the KTAR website. Meanwhile, for broadcast purposes, we will see you next week in the Think Tank.